Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and my co-host is Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition. Hi, Vicki.
Hello, everyone, and welcome.
Today, we're talking with Mark Benjamin and Katie Carpenter, co-directors of the powerful feature documentary Fatal Watch, now widely available on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, YouTube, and elsewhere. Fatal Watch exposes the darkest underbelly of global industrial fishing, telling the story of the murder and suspicious deaths of marine observers who are supposed to document illegal activity on fishing boats, but who, in shocking numbers, have ended up dead in the ocean, and how the industry, including the tuna industry, has created roadblocks for criminal investigators, leaving the families of the dead with no way to really know their loved ones' fates. Mark is an award-winning filmmaker, former combat cameraman, and founder of Brick City TV in New York. Katie is a longtime documentary filmmaker specializing in environmental topics for television, including several National Geographic specials. But before we get into all of that, some blue news you can use. On February 12th, the Trump administration announced it was getting rid of the EPA's endangerment finding that identifies climate change as a threat to human health and safety and the basis for regulating planet-warming greenhouse gases. Now, lots of people say this is being done to help big oil and coal that helped elect Trump in 2024. But with the government also reporting the ocean that covers 71% of our planet now hotter than ever before, while blue news generally isn't into conspiracy theories, have you considered what the last big oil and coal booster in the White House was? Who it was? Dick Cheney had an unhuman smile and lived for years without a functioning heart. Donald Trump has orange skin and hair. Robert Kennedy Jr., who doesn't want us to be vaccinated, looks like a lumpfish and eats roadkill. If aliens from a hotter planet wanted to terraform Earth with added carbon dioxide and methane so they could colonize it, might they not try and assume human form and then divide us by accusing our human neighbors of being the alien threat? They'd certainly promote a fossil fuel policy of drill, baby, drill, while shutting down cheaper clean energy projects like offshore wind. At the same time, they'd promote the spread of human diseases like measles. Blue News isn't claiming Trump's endangerment to humanity policy is an actual alien plot, but some people are saying, thank you for your attention to this matter. And that's blue news you can use. And now back to the show. So, Mark, Katie, normally we start by asking our guests how they first connected with the ocean. But in this case, let's jump right in. A lot of podcasts focus on true crimes, but not so many ocean documentaries. So what first gave you the idea for Fatal Watch?
Katie and I had done a series called Ocean Warriors. And that was 6 hours. And that was at Jackson Wild. And it won the best series. And as a result of that, we went back to Vulcan, to Paul Allen, and basically said, okay, what's next? And I think the conversation circled around the future of tuna. Would we look into that? And we didn't know, we didn't have a clue how to do that. Because I don't think anybody knows what the, even if you thought you had a clue, you might not be right. So that's what led us to go to the Pacific. In 2018, I went to the Pacific. I went to Fiji, Marshall Islands, New Zealand, ran around, asked a lot of questions. And we thought that this was the best way into the global crisis of overfishing to go through the door of a true crime story about four murders at sea, which are very real. But the real story we wanted to do was about the ocean, the future of the ocean. So, Katie, did I get part of that right?
That was 100% right. And to that, I would only add how far back we both go with ocean conservation and issues. And my first film assignment for National Geographic was back in the, God forbid, 80s. I was a toddler, of course. And we did whale language and dolphin language in Hawaii. And it was the first time I had ever been more than just a few weeks on the ocean. And I couldn't believe when these issues started popping up that that was even possible. I had such a naive view of what was going on. Fast forward to Ocean Warriors, as Ben says, that was our first dive into so many issues, not just illegal fishing, but dynamite fishing and all kinds of other crimes that occur around the fishing industry.
And for those who haven't seen the series, what is Ocean Warriors? Who are the Ocean Warriors?
So Ocean Warriors was a 6-part series. It was executive produced by Robert Redford and Paul Allen. And we had some heavy hitters who were driving us to really uncover what was going on in the ocean, the worst kinds of crimes and infringements. And our warriors were the law enforcement guys who were going out in boats and chasing the bad guys around and trying to apprehend them. And in the case of a few, we actually saw arrests and in one case, an actual conviction. But most of the time we learned it was pretty hard. And that's what made us want to keep chasing the story.
Yeah, I mean, we ran into this story of a observer going overboard and there was CCTV footage of his death. And somehow through connections, we got to the family and we got the footage. And we were hanging out at that time with a Interpol buddy, Alistair McDonald, because you worked with him in Chasing the Thunder and Ocean Warriors. And somehow it was pretty clear that this was a powerful piece of film. And what happened? And what happened was is a Chinese fleet owner must have told the captain who had seen the guy out of his mind. Maybe he was drugged. We don't really know. Naked on the deck of the boat. And he went overboard and no one helped him and no one reported it. So we thought we were going to go to China with Interpol and go to collar this captain. But things changed a lot with the geopolitical environment between the United States and China. So we never did get to China to put the cuffs on this captain who allowed this to happen. And we assume he was drugged because it's a common thing to do to drug observers if you want to have a free ride and fish anywhere you want without a license or any species you could. Like if you ran into bluefin, you'd take the bluefin over the skipjack just because of the value of the target.
So when you have footage like that, how do you visualize creating a whole story, telling a story about fisheries and human justice into a filmmaker's perspective?
This is kind of a hot football we're passing back and forth here because Papua New Guinea is a very difficult place to shoot. And we had to tell that story with very limited resources, archival footage and interviews. And you can see that there is a big story there, but you never quite get to the bottom of it. Whether we would have, there's various details that we weren't able to chase down. But it was true in all 4 cases of the marine observers that we followed. Each one had a previous example of having told on the owner of a vessel, whether they had reported that there was dumping of juvenile fish over the side in Ghana, or they had reported that there were catches much larger than were permitted. These kinds of crimes, when they're reported, can be very expensive for a fishing company. It can, all of a sudden, they're getting a penalty and it didn't fit into their business model.
When you saw this first footage, which is very dramatic, of this obviously drugged observer staggering to the front of the boat and then seeming to talk to somebody and then like falling backward into the ocean and they just sail on and ignore this. Did you sense that you were going to do a film about observers at risk? Were you even aware that this was not a one-off when you started this project?
We didn't know what film we were making. We thought it was about tuna. We then thought, oh, observers, that's a good way to get to tuna because they're on purse seiners. They don't have observers on longliners because they're rust buckets and they're slaves typically on longliners. So the sea slave thing is a problem for an observer. Conditions are just beyond. The problem for us was we didn't really know who our characters were. It was a process of discovery.
But let me add to one thing to that. The thing that really took us hook, line, and sinker, so to speak, into this film were the investigators. Because we knew for sure we had narrative flow when we met these investigators, Tim and Lagi and Richard Nyarko in Ghana. These guys were relentless. They really wanted to know what the heck was going on here. And they had a lot of time on the ocean. Richard had done time as an observer. He knew the ins and outs of the corrupt fishing industry there. And so these investigators said, let's go to the fish market in Vigo in Spain. I think we'll learn a thing or two. So we're like, yeah, let's go. So we found the 4 cases of the 22 that we had been following. We chose those 4 because they were each different in different ways. They took us to different places. but the investigators really helped us knit together the story.
And you really, this is a visually stunning and also global story. I mean, you go from Keith Davis' hometown in rural Texas to Ghana to Fiji to Panama. What was the logistics? And you had the budget, obviously.
That was the problem. The film started in 2018, and here it is, 26. So you see how long it took. And we never had the funding. We never got the budget for the film. We had a budget, but we never, ever got it. And then we finished the film. So a lot of this was a passion project.
The underwater photography combined with the footage of some of the heinous acts. But the underwater photography is stunning. So you blend this drama with beauty, with tension, with the investigations and the family. It's very powerful with a lot of the elements that people will find attractive as they're gripping their hands and like, oh my gosh, this is really tragic information.
I hate to talk about the investigators and not talk about the families, because the families were so important to this story. And Nikki in Fiji and Emmanuel's mom in Ghana. And Keith Davis's, I mean, everybody loved Keith Davis. So it was these perspectives and these testimonies were so important to describing how outrageous these crimes were. And I just spoke to one of our sources in Ghana last week, and they're over there they're fighting the good fight. They're trying to change some laws and get some enforcement dollars. And I don't think they're ever going to give up. So if there's any amount of give in the environment economically, I think they'll be able to turn this around. I'm very optimistic about that.
So Keith Davis was an American. Emmanuel Eslan was from Ghana. You have people who were disappeared observers from Fiji and elsewhere. Who are the observers and what's their role?
Therein lies the problem. The money that pays for observers comes from the fishing industry. And the RFMOs they sort of carry water for the fishing industry. So regional fisheries management organizations around the world manage regions where fisheries exist. And observers are hired by these local RFMOs, but the industry pays for it. So it's basically self-regulating. It's like the oil industry is being regulated by people the oil industry hires. The fishing industry hires people to regulate them, but they control all the data. So there is no real, the reality of who observers are and what they're doing is very much in question, but not by mainstream media. I have to say that mainstream media has a lot more respect, for instance, the word MSY or maximum sustainable yield, or the overfishing claims of the conservation movement relative to the fishing industry. It's controversial to say that there's overfishing going on a $40 billion industry. We don't really buy the sustainable argument. We understand the science in it.
These observers, how many of them are there? And obviously, when they get into it, what are they motivated? What are they doing with their lives?
It's been reported that between 2,000 and 3,000 observers globally. In the Western Central Pacific, there's about 900. And the question, like, what's your last word on how many observers have died? We have records in over 20-something, but we think there's much more than that, because it's just not reported. Why would you report it? You know, why? There's no interest in reporting it if you don't have to. So we don't really know. I don't know that anyone can answer that. We've been on this for 6 years now. There has not been one trial of a murder of an observer. No family, no sister, no mother, no daughter, no wife. Nobody went to trial for a lost observer. There's never been a court case. So that, to me, right there tells you this doesn't pass the sniff test. This is like, what do you mean? There's dead people. They didn't fall over. There's a gunwale. You don't fall over. You have to be pushed over. And so who killed these people? And that question is left out to dry. Nobody wants to talk about it.
We have the observer programs that are in the U.S. that are fairly well monitored. But with the high seas and the jurisdiction is so complex, can you describe how it's supposed to work? Because clearly, with the threats of them reporting things that they shouldn't report, obviously results in risk of life and all kinds of horrible things. But how is it supposed to work?
I should back up and give a little background, which I think your original question was, how do these guys get into this business? And the, what motivates them is really, in many cases, we touch upon it in the film, they're kids who love the ocean. They grew up, they went to college, they majored in marine biology. It's like in the old days, people used to join the merchant marine. Remember, they wanted a life at sea, and nobody told them this was an enforcement job. They thought they were going to be counting fish and filing reports. And I think that because they're in almost every case so poorly prepared for what lies ahead when somebody is going to confront them and possibly throw them overboard, they have no weapons, they have no radios, there's no whistle on their safety jacket. I mean, they're just totally unprepared for a life in crime enforcement. And I think that's part of the problem. So how is it supposed to work? These young guys are supposed to go out to sea for a year or two, take notes, excellent notes, report back. It helps conservation. They're setting limits on fisheries and everything's good and they go on with their lives. But no. And I think how it's supposed to work, if you do find a crime like this at sea, is the prosecutor will come out from the flag state and do a forensic analysis of some kind, take these guys in, put them through trial, they get convicted, and they go to jail. And that's what happened in Chasing the Thunder. But we never saw that.
And in the U.S., an observer, because of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, if an observer feels threatened, they can immediately be in contact with the U.S. Coast Guard. There'll be a boarding. There's penalties. Apparently, this doesn't exist elsewhere in the world, is what you're saying and what your film shows.
The thing about NOAA is if NOAA really cared about conservation, it would be the Department of the Interior. It wouldn't be the Department of Commerce. So NOAA, not unlike all the other RFMOs around the world, are the, well, it's a boys' club. The fishing industry is a club. Working with the governments where the fish live is a club. Where's the criminality there? We're not going to make accusations that we can't hold up to scrutiny, so I won't make any. But there's a lot of money flying around here. There's a very wealthy industry. And the industry uses the observers to feign transparency, to have observers all over the world in these fisheries to try to tell the world that we're doing things right, the fishing industry. They're very sophisticated. But you always have to say, who's paying them? The industry are paying the observers to observe what the industry is doing. And that's not justice. That's not environmental justice. This film is an indictment of the fishing industry. And not just for killing the four observers or even killing 40 observers. It's about what they're doing to the ocean, because we only have one chance with this ocean to get it right.
Professor Wisdom Akpolu at the University of Ghana in the end gives us a really interesting perspective. I think it bears repeating. He says, it's not a figment of our imagination that these fisheries could collapse. They can and they have. And when a fishery like the one off Ghana collapses, all those people, 3 million people who made their living in the fishing industry, they're going to be unemployed. They're going to turn to crime. They're going to become pirates because they're very good at sea. They're going to become refugees. They're going to walk up to Libya and get onto boats and try to get to Italy. So don't just be thinking we're trying to save Ghana here. We're trying to save everybody. And the ocean is essential to all those ECOWAS countries up the coast of West Africa. They're all in the same boat. It's imperative for all of us to get this story out as far as we can before one of these fisheries starts to collapse, and then we can really see what the consequences would be.
The human toll, like we talk about four murders in this film. Pew, while we were making the film, did a study of the dangers in the fishing industry. Yeah. It used to be 20,000-30,000 a year would die. The new study popped it up to 100,000 dead mariners a year. That's 300 dead mariners a year. Now you have to ask yourself, how the hell did that happen? And it happened because when you overfish and poach out nearshore waters, the small scale artisanal fisher, the small vessels, nearshore fishing, they try to go out further because the poachers, they diminish the species that lived in the waters near shore. So the fishermen have to go further. I.e., that's why you have 100,000 dead bodies at the end of a year. So the big picture is the ocean is being murdered by overfishing, and human life means nothing. There's no value in a breathing human to the fishing industry.
This is a finance story. Yeah. You've got subsidies that are being paid by the EU that are enabling some of these crimes. You've got access fees being paid by China to the 21 nations of the Pacific. There's bribes. There's just so much crazy finance. They're afraid to shut it down because there's so many things that rely on this business model happening this way.
Where many governments are subsidizing their fishing fleets, even as wild marine capture is being overfished. I think what's interesting is what you're saying is your film, which focuses on murderers and disappearances of observers, which may be, as you say, it's fairly shocking, maybe more than 20 people and no trials. And now you're talking about indirect murders, which is as this overfishing takes place, local fishermen and women are having to go further out to sea because the offshore industrial fishing is wiping out the stock that they depend on, the nearshore stock. So it becomes a scary and fascinating story that's told here.
It's international crime. A lot of concerns about sustainability. These observers were collateral damage. What do you really want us to know about what's going on in the ocean and the high seas? Like what? Just give it to us.
Okay, so you know that the House of Representatives has a committee that Brian Mass is running. It's called H.R. 6338, which is investigating overfishing by China, which everybody knows it's a superpower of global overfishing. And he wants to stop it. I think Trump wants to stop it. And that's why they've got this measure that's running around Capitol Hill. And they're on the phone with us, meaning they're calling us. They're looking at our film. They saw our film. The House Subcommittee on Chinese overfishing has had the film for 2 months before it even went on video on demand. So we were on their radar because of Ian Rowby. That's how this all happened. Ian Rowby also pushed us to what's called the United States Naval War
College.
In Rhode Island. They have the film also. So people are looking at the film for two things. They're looking at the murder story, it's criminality at sea, and that fits into the buckets of both the House and the Rhode Island Naval War College. And so they're looking at our film and they're sort of dissecting it and trying to figure out what we saw that they need to be aware of. So you've got these staffers calling us and asking us, what happened in this scene? Because they're dissecting the film. They have a transcript. They say, what happened here? And we tell them, well, we don't have the answers. We spent 6 years. We still don't have the answers. And we just think that the industry knows what they're doing. They're keeping the cover on this $40 billion industry. And they're going to want you to think that everything is kosher, and it's not.
So, Katie, we've just seen after a 20-year battle, the UN pass a high seas treaty that is supposed to protect biodiversity on the high seas. And they're pretty clear it's about protecting sharks and sea turtles' migratory patterns. This is almost half the planet, the high seas. And this is where much of what you describe in your film is taking place. Is this a mechanism that might actually lead to enforcement or protection? What do you think? What's your take?
I mean, we were very supportive of the campaign to pass the High Seas Treaty. There's no question that a lot of the criminality that we saw and researched was happening in the high seas, and that you see that scene where they're tracking one of the vessels, the Windfar 6-3-6, and they're tracking it. It goes out of Fiji waters, and then it goes out of Nauru waters, and then it disappears into the high seas. But the problem with the High Seas Treaty is the money for enforcement has not yet appeared. And some of these countries, like Palau, has one enforcement vessel. Fiji has two. So if they've got a fleet of 51 Chinese vessels fishing in their waters and they've got two 30-foot enforcement vessels, it's not going to do it. And it's certainly not going to do it if they get outside the EEZ and they're out fishing in the high seas. And we've seen the terrible things that can happen out there. I mean, Ian Urbina did that incredible investigation into the Fiji cell phone video where they had captured a shot of all these mariners being shot and thrown overboard.
I was once told by law enforcement that the maritime police there would walk over 1,000 dead sea turtles to get to a kilo of cocaine. And so to see the illegal fishing as maybe food security, even more essential than drug interdiction. And Also, the fact that all crime tends to interconnect, as you said earlier, and as you show in the film, the people who are smuggling people or the same people who are overfishing and human trafficking and the like.
Well, Ben, what do you think about the High Seas Treaty?
There's no enforcement. There's no enforcement teeth. There's no money. There's no ships. There's no countries. Nobody's offering ships. Nobody's offering coast guards. This whole High Seas Treaty thing is helium. I mean, it's just like gets everybody high, but what's it really going to do for the fish and the ocean? Everybody is trying to virtue signal. I'm not eating any sushi because it's like harpooning a manatee. I don't want to kill that tuna because they're being overfished. And so I'm not going to eat tuna anymore because I want to be PC. Well, that signaling, as Daniel Pauly said, is not going to do much. It's better if you go to Wall Street and protest there where they're underwriting more overfishing capacity for China with American money on Wall Street, downtown, 5 minutes from where I live downtown. They're raising money to get more vessels with subsidies and without. It doesn't matter. So Daniel's saying all this virtue signaling, eat your tuna, don't eat it, but go to fight the establishment.
Get active. Yeah. Join Blue Frontier or the Inland Ocean Coalition.
Join Blue Frontier. Join Oceana. If you've got some money, join Oceana. If you don't have any money, join Greenpeace. Go wherever you fit in. I mean, go to a place where you feel comfortable that's doing ocean conservation, because I wouldn't know what to tell you what to do.
And when people ask me, are you hopeful or optimistic or pessimistic? It's like, no, I believe in triage. We're going to save what we can while we can. It's not going back to what it was, but we don't have to kill the last fish either.
That's a good way to put it.
If our listeners want to watch Fatal Watch, where do they go?
They can go to Apple TV. They can go to Amazon Prime. They can go to YouTube. They can go to Vimeo. They can go to Journeyman Picture, Journeyman TV, which is our international distributor. And it's pretty easy to get. It's $3. It's not too, you know, it's not too hard.
No excuse not to see it. Get some intestinal fortitude and watch this amazing, scary film about what's really going on the high seas.
Well, thank you very much, Mark Benjamin and Katie Carpenter, co-directors of Fatal Watch, for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. And everybody, get out there and watch that documentary.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helvark and me, Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the Blue Frontier. Salty ocean, off to the blue frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky, there you are. Good boy, Sparky.